well, this is another stab at Cohen Meander. I don't have my rig at all. I don't have my stuff, so it's gonna be a pretty shaky recording. Hang in there. I think I'm gonna call this one color blind, and I'll tell you what prompts this. First of all, I've done a lot of job interviews in my time. I can't stay with jobs very readily. Probably a personality flaw. I don't know if I get bored easy. That's probably it. So if I want to try to make it sound good, I'll say once I've figured out a job, I'm not interested in it anymore. That's probably why I have the job I have now, because it's being meted out to me very slowly. And most of the time, other members of my team basically do the job for me. And I get a little cranky because I say, hey, wait, how am I going to learn how to do this if you guys aren't sitting here making me do it, walking me through it? And so I have to kind of draw it out of them a little bit, and it's probably good because it'll probably keep me here for several years, which is probably the larger plan, is to try to get me to keep doing this job for as long as they can, because the biggest problem isn't getting somebody competent, I think. And I'm not saying I'm competent. The biggest problem is getting somebody just to be there and do it. So, anyway, beyond that, I will hearken back to this one interview. It was an interview to teach Linux, which is what I've been involved with for quite a while. It's a computer operating system, more and more popular with sincerely back-end, back-office, back in some data center room. Always a decent number of jobs available, far more than people feel comfortable with that. Usually they have to hire people that really have very little experience with it, but they say, well, you're kind of a computer person, so we think you'll catch on. And so I was going for one of those jobs. There are guys that are really intensely good at this stuff, that really have important and fantastic things to say, and they should get those kinds of teaching jobs and get paid very well. The jobs actually pay quite well. They're really nice because they tend to be kind of on the part-time side, or we're not going to really keep an eye on how long you're taking doing this job, and they'll pay $50, $55 an hour, and you just go, you know, you swallow your tongue, and you go, that's a lot of money. And you go, that's right. It says, but the pressing need for people who can do this kind of work necessitates how much money you have to pay people who do the preparation. Anyway, so I was going for one of these jobs, and I was very... And we started having the interview. Before it even started, because I knew that this was going to be a hang-up in the DEI sphere, I preface the whole thing by saying, you have to understand, this is, and I want to know if this is going to be a problem. It says, I come from a generation and a mindset that sees the way to handle differences of culture, differences of color, crap like that that I, it says, I don't give it much thought, and I don't care. I don't care about that. It says, I came from the time when you needed to be colorblind. You just tried never to look at these things, and you don't. And I tried to explain that to them and said, I know this is kind of a generational thing, and I'm older than probably you are. It says, and this is such a big thing. Now, it says, and it hasn't been in the past because we would hire somebody based on their output, what they could do for us. And silly things like the color of their skin or the background that they came from or the weird behavioral hang-ups they might have, we ignore those. You know, a whole lot of people say, oh, it's really good to get into computers because computers tends, the information technology field tends to ignore things like people who don't, who aren't very good socially, you know. Now they're called neurodivergent. That's kind of risen as a nice way of saying you're autistic or you've got Asperger's syndrome or you're just really shy, you're not outgoing enough to be a great manager or a great leader or something like that. And it didn't really matter. It recently came out, or I read an article, I don't think it's come out lately. I don't know when in his life he got diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, but it was Bill Gates. And you go, well, Bill Gates is, you know, he's one of the masters of the universe, right? And, you know, and it said, and how come he ever got to be one of those kinds of people? And you go, well, number one, he started his own company with a partner. Number two, his Asperger's made it so that he was actually quite a good software engineer, and that's where he came. It was actually a good confluence of what he had and the times. This was when computers were just beginning to be interesting, and he was at the very beginning of what we would call personal computing. And his ability not to get kind of hung up on other aspects of, like, business. One of my great, one of the people I always appreciated looking at was a fella named Gary Kildall. He was really kind of ahead of Bill Gates on a lot of things. He'd gotten into this, but I don't think he was particularly a really wonderful engineer. He kind of fell into it, kind of like I did. And he died younger, not very well. He wasn't competitive. Bill Gates was a focused winner. Anyway, so What ended up becoming information technology, which back in the old days didn't didn't really have a name. It was more like being a computer hobbyist. Bill Gates really excelled there. Although under most circumstances, like if you ever got diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome in the past, you would not be allowed in the military because the military does not want to have to put up with some of the weirdness that comes around it. My son, one of my sons, talked too much when he was in the Air Force, and they figured out how to get him out of the Air Force by saying that he had autism. And of course, later on, he really didn't want to have that stigma, and so he got with a psychologist who said, it's nothing to worry about. And so he got a piece of paper that said he was going to be okay. The Air Force wouldn't have him back anyway. It didn't matter to them. Once you get out, once you get drummed out, that's it. It's over. But the Army was going to be a little bit more accommodating of him. And I don't know where that's gone. We really haven't talked about it lately. He's on other tracks now, so I don't know how much he's really interested in the Army anymore. I don't know if I really want to bring it up because I don't want him to get the impression that I will think less of him if he doesn't follow through on that. I don't. I said, you can do whatever you want, man. This is cool. Anyway, getting back to color blindness. So I explained this to this recruiter lady. I often get recruited. I don't often have to search for jobs, although I do. The jobs usually come and find me. The last two jobs I've had, they came to me. I occasionally get a headhunter coming. And it's not to say that I'm really amazing or it's wonderful. It's just that there's so much demand in these fields that they're scrambling to get whatever they can get. Anyway, so I explained all this about the thing that my generation found most important about dealing with different kinds of people, which was just to ignore the differences. Don't be weird about them. If you bring the skill set that we need, I don't care about anything else. You come and you give us the skill set that we need, that's what I care about. And I said, and that's what I'm going to teach too. This is you need to build up a good skill set. It isn't just about having, well, can I be honest? I said, most of the jobs I get headhunted for are jobs that have to do with my credentials. They have seen my resume on various places, and they look me up. Credentials are one thing. Being able to say that you've done some things means even a ton more. Of course, education can only handle one side of that particularly, especially when it's the newfangled kind of education where you're at a distance and it's really easy to fake that you can do something, and there's really no way to stop that from happening. You know, you try, but you fail. Anyway, so okay, I keep doing these divergences because I think it's interesting. But so I explained color blindness to this person. Of course, she said, well, it's all about DEI now, and you have to spend a lot of time and effort making sure that all these different aggrieved groups that you understand them and that you accommodate for them. And I said, you know what? In this field, it has nothing to do with accommodation at all. We're not here to take care of you. If you can put out the stuff, we don't care. I remember at a job some years ago, one of my coworkers was the fattest person you have probably ever encountered. He had all kinds of different chairs. He had a personal assistant because he was so difficult to move. But these were the days before you could dial it in, that particularly. So he had to show up at work every day. I don't know how much time it took for him to get to work. I think he had a special vehicle to handle the fact that he probably weighed on the order of 800 pounds. He was kept around, as far as I was aware of, he was kept around because he had such a unique and vital skill set for a system that we were was being taken care of, to the point to where it didn't matter. I never asked him how much money he made. I'm sure it would have made my jaw drop, because his particular skill set could marshal that kind of money. I don't know if the company, the Defense Department, I don't know if the company paid for his personal assistant. I don't know if he paid for that personal assistant. Some lady that basically went and took care of everything, brought him, he seemed to eat copiously, you know. You get to 800 pounds by not having culinary control of yourself. People can say that, oh, it's a genetic thing, it's this, it's that, you know, you can't do anything about it. And you go, maybe. And you go, I don't know. It says, but that's just to let you know that if you have a skill set in a field where you're just desperate for it, I don't know if he was really good at COBOL or something interesting like that, that was really, you know, the government especially is really bad at hanging on to really, really intensely old technology. And the problem is, you start losing the people who have the ability to work with that technology. I think that's what kept him around. And you look at it that way and you go, it doesn't matter if you weigh 800 pounds. Of course, all those DEI people would say, well, you can't discriminate against him because he is weight challenged, and we need to get him a support group that makes him feel good about being weight, you know, being 800 pounds. And you go, well, this is, you know, this is all we do is he has a skill set that we need. We pay him, you know. Says if he needs a personal assistant, he wants to pay for it out of the money we pay him. Hey, good for him. You know, I don't care. Says as long as he gets the job done. Now, if he starts costing the company a lot of money, the Department of Defense was a very early kind of proto DEI outfit. Which means that when Donald Trump came and he said, we're going to get rid of all that, it's a hard thing to do. You know, government is the first place where wild, crazy ideas get hatched. Anyway, so we talked about all this, and she was doing it in her terms, and I was saying, you know, it says when it comes to technology, it doesn't matter. If you've got the stuff, who cares? They don't care. That was one of the first, the very first people to get into this field, just kind of computers that were accessible. That was what personal computers became. Now they're huge and monstrous, but they were built on personal computers. There are very few mainframe sorts. That also may be where that 800-pound guy kept his job, was the fact that he probably worked with a handful of the mainframes that the government still has to keep doing. International Business Machines, IBM, still, it was that they were among the first to really commercialize mainframes. And and they still put them out. They're trying to make them into these Linux boxes so that modern people can touch them. They can be more accessible. But they still sell mainframes, basically updated versions of 80-year-old computers. I'm getting older, so these are computers from like the 1960s or the 1950s. And it really ends up being, who are these people who are willing to work on these computers? And everybody would tell these kind of people, oh, that is so passe. That is so bleh. You don't have to, you know. If you really want to get ahead in your career, and this guy wasn't a manager. He was just one guy. He was a guy that's all by himself. He was actually managed by my group. And the managers basically said, that's his stuff. I don't tell him what to do. He doesn't tell me what to do. And we all agree. Except that he has to have these interesting chairs and these interesting things. He couldn't sit upright. Anyway, and that's just a really crude example, crude on a couple of ways. A crude example of certain business computing tasks not caring anything about anything except your ability to make the thing keep working. Some government agency needed basically 1960s computers to keep doing what they were doing. And there is a certain market, it's very, very small, but it can employ permanently the old computer high priests who were the only guys that really understood any of this stuff enough to get it done. And he was one of these guys. He wasn't terribly old, so I think he had, in those days, it was almost more of an apprenticeship. You would go and you would be among these high priests and you would learn their secrets. And that was, and there's still parts of the technology there, but that's not really where I came from, but that's where I got my start. And and ultimately, what started out as being a very warm interview died out to being a very cold interview and saying, you know what, we're not going to put you forward to the organization because we don't think we can get past the fact that you don't seem very willing to do the DEI thing. The thing that's very heartening to me is that DEI is very much against the ropes. It's fighting back as hard as it can. I think we're always going to have some organizations that are very DEI. The whole thing that all organizations had to adopt diversity, equity, and inclusion. Is gone. I think there's some organizations that will. There have always been things like that, but I think it's only going to be in certain silos. But anyway, I like color blindness because, to a large extent, I think this is how reality authentically works. God even says he's no respecter of persons. You're not going to get to heaven. You're not going to get in a special just not going to get, oh, this is bad, because usually my thing will cut off when it says there's some silence, but since I'm not using my proper equipment, it never cuts off. Be no respecter of persons. I mean, it doesn't matter where you were born, it doesn't matter where you came from, it doesn't matter where your parentage is. Jesus made these kinds of overtures on occasion, but he constantly said, you know, there's a standard to be met. You know, you have to be repentant. You have to be the kind of person that's humble and teachable, a broken heart, a contrite spirit. These were the things. And it didn't matter if you had a black skin, or it didn't matter if your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were slaves. It did not matter to him at all. In fact, you can see it in the whole wandering Israelite experience after they left Egypt. God took them out into the wilderness, offered them something wonderful. They basically rejected it. So he left them out there for 40 years, wandering around in the wilderness, basically getting rid of that slave generation and letting their children get into this. Because they were so hung up on their slavery. We would rather go back to the flesh pots of Egypt and be their slaves again, because we're getting better food. We got better food from them than we're getting out here in the wilderness. And it's like, yeah, okay, well, there it is, huh? Sorry, I just looked for a minute on my work phone. I am very much grateful for fact that what God really ends up saying is, you got to be colorblind. You know? But the whole DEI thing is, they say, no, you cannot be colorblind. Never. It says, you need to give these people, all these people who are aggrieved, so you need to catalog all these grievances, because they're very, very important. Black people get this special privilege because we don't treat, you know, because we don't feel like blacks get treated very well. Or they have this background of slavery, but only some of them do. And so far in the past, what difference does it make anymore? Anyway, or Jim Crow or stuff like that. And you're going, you know what? They said, the way a lot of black people finally got successful, and this was even back in the times of Jim Crow, was the fact that they brought compelling abilities to the table. And if some dumb company had a stupid idea that said, oh no, We think blacks are stupid, and you had this amazing engineering mind that just happened to be wrapped in a black skin body, another company would say, we don't care. Look at what he can do. And that's where that came from. At some point, the whatever benefits come from being kind of a DEI thing, which I think is kind of them paying a little lip service to colorblindness, but not really. You know, that guy got a job, and he was this engineer, and he ended up being a huge leader in the field, because it didn't matter what color he was. He could still have hang-ups about, you know, you know, I was the son of slaves. Most successful people would say, don't do that. Bill Cosby, when he was in good shape, And before it was really out that he was really a, kind of a horrible, wretched, abusive man to women, he was the first one to say the biggest thing keeping black people down are black people. All talking about how they're a bunch of losers. He was a person that they hoped was going to buy the entire NBC television network. And this was long before the principles of DEI became this huge thing. His last really successful show, which was called The Cosby Show, although it brought up some themes of blackness, it was basically just a family who was successful and all the things that they went through, because he's a comedian. DEI kills all comedy. It just becomes ranting. And yeah, this is, and you can't be funny and do this. It's like, you know, people who go to shows and it's all about, you know, here are the feminists of comedy. And you're going, no, they're either deeply gross or they're just sitting there trying to virtue signal really hard. And everybody in the place is basically there because they're trying to virtue signal too. And they laugh when there's a cue to laugh, because if they don't, they aren't hip or something, you know. Anyway, so it's really interesting. I don't think I've lost jobs over DEI. But I was always trying to head off at the pass the fact that I would be gotten rid of because of DEI. One of my greatest things about any job I've ever had is that I don't want to be fired by any place. If I get any kind of sense that because of circumstances I'm not going to be able to accomplish what I'm hired to do, if I can't do it, I will leave before it gets to that point. I don't know if people give me a good recommendation or not. I tend to ask for recommendations from the jobs that kind of have to say, would you hire him back? And it would. Like Eastern New Mexico University has to say they would hire me back because they already had a couple of times. And I had done all these wonderful things for them. And when you go, so he left to take a higher paying job, but you're not going to hire him back. But he got you from one place to the next place. He spent 4 years doing this huge, massive upgrade to your underlying systems, and you won't hire him back? And you go, and yet you did once. And you go, yeah. And it's like, okay. And it makes it so that if they tried to say bad things, they would look like idiots. Which is fine, you know. I like it when they come back and they go, well, we talked to his people, but I swear the places he worked for, no wonder he took another job that paid better. Oh my gosh, you know, he's, whoa. Anyway, and I'm not saying that I'm God's gift to anything. I'm certainly not God's gift to, like, say, Linux or computer engineering or anything along those lines. I think I've always basically just lived off the fact that I was smart. Not that I had any particularly magnificent skill set or even the right attitudes about it. I can get the jobs and then I can work my way through the jobs. anyway, so, yeah, the whole thing about being colorblindness, and I was talking about Jesus. I think Jesus is colorblind. I think God is colorblind. I don't think he sent people to Africa to swelter and die because he didn't like them. Just as a group or something. So that's not God. God says so. Scriptures say so. Even when you do have grievances, God says, don't have grievances. You know, that kind of comes from the whole idea of being forgiving. It's saying, even if somebody has treated you bad, don't treat them bad back. And you go, that's right, you know. Love your neighbors. Do good to them who curse you. Things like that. And you're going, that is one of the, that is an element of being colorblind. Or a larger thing than even being colorblind, you know, is not pigeonholing people for one thing or another. So yeah, there you go. Colorblindness. Tricky, tricky thing. All right. This is Jason Nimro. This has been Cohen Meander, and I'll leave it at that.